Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine. I am here with the Doctor of Democracy himself, Terry D. Kester.
Terry D. Kester, indeed.
The self-proclaimed Doctor of Democracy, the Master of Sagacity, and I don't know what other titles that they were given to you by the Dalai Lama. Or at
yes, least... as a matter of fact, I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, it was the Dalai Lama. The Pope was there, but he didn't vote. It was an awkward situation, but the Dalai Lama came through for us.
I understand. Did they, like, blow the white smoke out to declare you Doctor of Sagacity? Or...
It wasn't white smoke. No, it was brown. It was green. It was a little ugly, as a matter of fact. A lot of things were burning, mostly documents.
Oh, I would think it was drugs, but...
I don't think so.
We are actually getting live video, Terry. We're going to see your beautiful mug. Eventually, by the way, we're going to get you in on Skype, and then we can actually see you actually move and not just an old black and white photo with a hat. But at least that's a start.
That was my glorious days when I was with the Norwegian Navy.
The Norwegian Navy. Was that 1853? When was that?
It was 1906.
1906.
Yeah.
Were you down in the Antarctic expedition with the Norwegian Navy?
Yes, I did, yes.
Oh, okay. I was just reading about that today. I hope you didn't fall and slip on the ice. for those of you who do not know Terry D. Kester, the self-proclaimed Doctor of Democracy,
I've got the certificate. I've got the same as Donald Trump. I've got the certificate.
I see. and where is the certificate from?
It's from my office.
Ah, okay. Well, like Donald Trump, you're very good at self-promotion. So,
thank you.
As I said, this is the Raucous Caucus. We tend to be a little raucous here. This is Mark Levine with Terry D. Kester. Garland Nixon may or may not be joining us. He's a bit under the weather, but we hope he'll join us a little bit later. What I want to talk about today, and I know Terry does too, is the ways of Washington, specifically the ways in which democracy is thwarted by the people elected by the voters.
Now, what a concept. Isn't it great? I guess they have never read the Constitution.
Well, it seems contradictory, but actually when you think about it, if the only way you could stay in power when a majority of voters want you out, if you allow every one of them to vote and you allow the majority to rule, you're not going to be in business very long. So politicians are finding really some old and new and really creative ways to make sure that minorities can rule. And there's a whole bunch of them. We're going to go through them in this hour. Everything from filibusters to gerrymanders to anonymous ways to hold bills to holding up nominations to waiting till someone's out of town to do a vote, a surprise vote. There's at least six others, and we'll be going into them today. Terry, I guess what got me on this topic, and there's a long list of things, as I've mentioned, but you may have heard that just about a week ago in my home state of Virginia, the Senate in Virginia is split 20-20. It's exactly tied. So the lieutenant governor would normally break the deciding vote. He is a Republican. The governor is Republican. That the House is Republican. But the Senate, as I said, is 20-20. And so the Republicans and the Democrats came to a deal right after the last redistricting. And the deal was, well, Republicans control the House and Democrats control the Senate this time. So both sets of politicians will do maps that help them get reelected. So
how nice.
Instead of actually doing what I don't know what I would like, but the governor said he'd like what most Virginia voters, American voters, said they like, which is to draw fair districts and give everyone an equal chance to be elected. They decided to draw districts that help themselves. Okay, that's bad enough. But what goes one further is the Republicans loved redrawing the lines to make sure that they will never be unelected in the House. But they were upset that the Democrats did exactly the same thing that they did. So the Senate was a 20-20 vote. They couldn't overturn the district map. The Virginia Constitution says this is only to be done every 10 years anyway. They went to the lieutenant governor who breaks the deciding vote, and he said, I can't change the maps. This was a deal. I'm not going to go back on my word. Besides, you can only change the maps every 10 years. Wait 10 years. So they knew that they could not pass it on a 20-20 vote because the person who broke the tie, Lieutenant Governor Bowling, would not be on their side. So they decided to do something else. On Martin Luther King Day, last Monday, when the President of the United States was inaugurated,
and which is a national holiday.
Which is a national holiday and one where legislatures normally do not meet on that day. They waited until a noted civil rights leader, a member of the Virginia Senate, someone who'd been a black guy, who'd been a civil rights leader out of Richmond for a generation. He had the, you would think, the pretty safe idea of attending Barack Obama's inauguration. They waited till he was out of town. They waited till they knew he'd left Richmond and appeared in Washington, which is a two-hour drive away on a if you're driving very, very fast. And then before he could get back, during the inauguration, on a national holiday, they put in a surprise bill to rejigger all the districts and make them so that a Democrat can never be elected in Virginia for the next 50 years. And they got it through by a 20-19 vote with one absentee. Because they knew this black Democratic leader.
You got to admire him for creativity, though. they just will stop at nothing.
It was creative, indeed, particularly when the whole goal was to disenfranchise black people by making sure that a legislator was out of the state attending a black president's inauguration on Martin Luther King Day.
Well, disenfranchising blacks has been Virginia's goal since, 1600. You know, and they just never changed that. I'm sorry to say that, but there is still considerable. Believe me, back in the country, I have some property back in the Shenandoah Valley, and you get back into that area, and I hate to say it, but racism is rampant in Virginia. I hate to say it, but it is.
And just one last thing, to end the session after, because they only allowed 30 minutes of debate, because if they allowed more, then...
Somebody might think.
Well, no. The guy could come home from the inauguration in panic and actually vote it down. And then they ended by closing the session in honor of Confederate General Stonewall Jackson.
See what I mean? The Civil War isn't over.
It was a complete, and they actually claimed that this was helping black voters because it created one more majority African-American district. Basically, they went through the state, packed all the African-Americans into one district, thus making sure that a population that might have five or six votes or more in the south side of Virginia could have exactly one. So there you go.
Gerrymandering, yes, the true art of democracy.
Now, what's interesting is that the governor of Virginia, who is a Republican, keeps saying he's a moderate Republican. He's looking at running for president, Governor McDonnell. And this is putting him in a bind, because if he signs this legislation, then it proves for once and for all that this is a guy who's bent on achieving power no matter how.
Hasn't he announced that he is opposed to it, though?
He said that he didn't know about it. He has not said yet whether he said it was, this is not the way legislation should be done in the dark of night. He criticized it, but he hasn't said that he'll veto it. You see. It's as Stephen Colbert famously said, it's like saying about a panda sandwich. I think it's disgusting, but hey, are you throwing that away? I mean, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, if it's already there and cooked, I have a bite.
There is one question I have on this. I mean, I was just double checking my constitution before the show, and is as nefarious as their procedure. Each state does have the right to determine how the electoral votes are determined. Correct.
True. But in fact,
Nebraska and Maine. Essentially have the same system already that Virginia is proposing.
Well, that's a different thing. I want to be very clear here. That's a different issue, and that's the designation of the electoral vote count. I'll tell you what, Terry, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about that element of it, because that's important, too. They also try that in Pennsylvania, and that's a different way to elect the President of the United States, so that in Virginia, for example, Barack Obama, having won the state, would only get four of the state's 13 electoral votes, or less than a third. Anti-majoritarian is ruling. We'll get to that, by the way, and you can call in, too, if you want to join in. 202-889-9797. We'll be right back with more of the Raucous Caucus right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with Terry D. Kester talking about really, Terry, you're the doctor of democracy, but we're talking about ways in which democracy is being thwarted by our politicians. I found out the name of the senator that was out of town. I just got that. It's Henry Marsh, 79 years old, African-American civil rights veteran, had the audacity on Martin Luther King Day to attend the African-American United States president's inauguration. And while they were gone, the Republicans took away the black representation in the Virginia Senate. Nice little trick there. I got you, Don, Terry?
Or maybe racist and not clever.
It was actually clever and racist. You can be clever and racist at the same time. There's no contradiction between the two.
Oh, okay.
Now, you were pointing out, and I want to get to the electoral vote tricks in just a second.
Well, they just left no stone unturned, you know.
Well, that's true. But you point out quite rightly that under federal law, there is no law against gerrymandering. I don't know if you know the history. Do you know where the word came from?
Oh, back in my history days, of course I knew it, and of course I was there when it happened.
I understand. I'm sure you remember when Governor Elbridge Gerry, by the way, even though it's written Gerry, he pronounced it Gerry, but people don't know that, so they call it gerrymandering. It should be gerrymandering. Anyway, in about 1830, Governor Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts drew districts to help his party, and it had sort of a fat body, and then it curved around in a neck. Those of you watching on video can see my hand motions. Curved around in the neck, and the great political cartoonist, American Thomas Nast, drew little fangs and feet and called...
Yeah, it looked like a dragon.
Well, it actually was a salamander.
Oh, okay.
And so they called it a gerrymander. Today we call it a gerrymander. The name has stuck ever since. But this is certainly an old practice. And as you point out, it's perfectly legal. Now, there may be state provisions that stop it. Like, I would argue the Virginia Constitution, which says you can only do this every 10 years, prohibits this. But there
is... In the state constitution.
That's right. But it's absolutely legal under federal law. Both Democrats and Republicans have done it. Maryland did it to get one more Democratic seat. But Republicans are masters of it, and we should never stop repeating the fact that a majority of Americans voted for Democrats in the House of Representatives, but Republicans control the House solely out of their districting lines. So these are ways in which politicians representing a minority of the American population can control things.
And it's significant to point out, too, in the case of Virginia, the division really is trying to exclude Northern Virginia almost entirely from electoral power.
That's true.
And it's the rest of the state, not all of the state, but the majority of the state that is conservative and very conservative and Republican for the most part. And if it's not Republican, it's good old boy Democrats, which is almost as bad as Republicans.
But while that's true of a majority of the rest of Virginia, it is not true of the majority of Virginia. Northern Virginia,
right,
it's about one-third of the population, and, of course, voted for President Obama both in 2008 and 2012, has two Democratic senators, and also a Republican governor. It's a purple state. I mean, I'm not going to call it a blue state, but it certainly is not a red state anymore, the state entirely, including Northern Virginia. So they did this trick. We still don't know. We're going to find out probably Tuesday whether the governor wants to scuttle his presidential bid and go down the partisan route by accepting this thing, or whether he will actually rise above it or cynically run for president and allow Virginia citizens to determine their own government.
Well, it's truly throwing out the idea of one person, one vote.
That's right.
I mean, you know, it's just sabotaging that concept entirely.
That's exactly right. And further sabotage is the thing that you mentioned, Terry, that's also going on in Virginia, Pennsylvania, and trying in various states. You are right that there are two states, Nebraska and Maine, that currently elect the president. Every electoral vote is basically – so the electoral vote count consists of combining a state's Senate and House of Representatives – numbers together. So every state has a minimum of three electoral votes because every state has two senators and one member in the House. So they all have a minimum of three. And the idea in Nebraska and Maine, relatively small states with, I think, four and five electoral votes, is they do two votes for whoever wins the entire state and then one vote per congressional district. But Nebraska and Maine, Nebraska is a pretty red state and Maine's a pretty blue state, and they're not known for being extremely partisan in their redistricting efforts, so these things don't matter much. But the proposal of Republicans in Virginia and Pennsylvania is fascinating because Virginia and Pennsylvania are blue states. Virginia in the last two elections, Pennsylvania in the last six or so. I don't think they voted for a Republican since Ronald Reagan. But by designing the electoral vote count based on congressional district, they could actually make sure that a majority of the citizens do not get their vote. In Virginia is a classic example. There are 13 electoral votes in Virginia. According to the Republican plan, if the election that was held in 2012 were held again, majority of Virginia voters voted for Obama, Obama would get four electoral votes and Mitt Romney nine. He would get 70% having lost the state. Pretty cool, huh?
Well,
if you're a Republican.
But it's not legal, and this is what's, you know, fascinating about it, because what originally, as I understand it, the delegates for the electoral college,
right,
could vote any way they wanted.
That's
they
true.
Were simply elected. Originally, they were elected or appointed by the state legislatures.
That's
and they could vote any way they wanted. They could vote, you know, for George Washington or for Thomas Jefferson or whoever they wanted to vote for. They weren't committed. When did this commission that they had to be committed to what one party or the other?
Well, it really started pretty early. One thing to be clear, some did it by the legislatures. Many did it by a popular vote. So that's not it.
It was a choice.
But you chose among the electors, and the idea of the founders were the electors would, without any idea of party, simply meet and choose the best candidate. You know, this idea has frankly been dead pretty much since the election of 1800. I mean, once Adams and Jefferson started the idea of political parties, there were always faithless electors, supposed electors that didn't vote for who they were pledged for. But pretty much for the last 200 years, even though it's not in the Constitution, this idea that electors are going to be pledged to a certain person. And then as time went on, states actually began punishing electors who didn't vote for the way they were designated to vote.
And that always changes thought. But it's also interesting that George Washington felt that if we got into a two-party system, that it would be to the country's detriment.
That's true.
You know, the ideal thing was, you know, sort of that there was representative government without political dominance by one group or the other. That was the ideal. That hasn't worked out too well.
Well, I think Washington is the only president we've ever had to rise above party. Every other president.
Probably.
And maybe that's why he thought it was possible.
Yes, he was first, so he could do it, and that was about it.
But I think humanity has shown that at least two parties, if not more, is sort of the nature of the human condition. I hate the Electoral College. I would abolish the whole thing and just have the popular vote win. But what I want to focus on today is just all the different anti-majoritarian measures that a Congress can take or a legislative body can take. We mentioned gerrymandering. We mentioned the Electoral College tricks. There's also the clearest one, the one they just fixed, or didn't fix. They just slightly changed recently, and that's, of course, the filibuster in the Senate. And I want to get that after a very brief break. If you want to call in 202-889-9797 and join in the discussion, let us know what you think
I thought this was time for my filibuster.
It will be as soon as we come back, Terry,
I
promise.
Okay.
We'll be right
back
right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with Terry DeKester talking about all the ways in which a minority can make sure the majority can never take power. I don't quite want to compare the political parties in America to Hitler. It's always a dangerous thing. But let's just say this. Let's never forget the fact that Hitler never won a majority election in Germany. He won about 42% in his best election ever, and then he took power and then made sure that no one else could vote him out. So the idea of minorities taking over governments is certainly a tried and true concept used by the most nefarious among us. We've been talking about gerrymanders. We've been talking about manipulating electoral vote count. Now, Chad, I want to move on to the filibuster.
Yes, a true American tradition. And it's not like Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
No, it really isn't. Tell us why.
No, it never has been.
Well, I would argue that prior
to...
It was a little better.
I mean, it was a little more open, to be sure. And
no,
was,
but...
You know, at least the person had to directly participate.
Right.
And had to do the filibuster himself, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Prior to 1970, so the filibuster, of course, is comes off a pure clerk's error. I'm so mad at that clerk in 1800. Because the first Congress, in both the Senate and the House, said that when you do a motion to stop the debate stops, and then you have a majoritarian vote, and we're done. And that House still has that rule today. In 1800, when they were writing down the rules from the last Congress, some clerk forgot to include that rule from the Senate. Now, why does a clerk's error 212 years ago matter? Because when they found out 10 years later or so that, oh, they forgot to include that rule, they said, that's okay. Senators will simply stop debating when they're done, and then we'll get to a vote, because we're all good, wonderful people. And then some senator found out in the 1820s, 1830s, that if they just kept talking, they could kick the bill from ever coming to a vote. Anyway, fast forward to the present. Now, it requires 60 votes to force a vote in the Senate, and you don't even have to keep speaking anymore. I mean, Mr. Smith goes to Washington. At least he kept talking through the night, right?
Not only do you don't have to keep on speaking, but all you have to do is threaten to have the filibuster.
That's true.
And that usually kills the situation unless there's a very strong majority by one party or the other, which rarely happens. And as I understand, you can even threaten to do the filibuster without revealing who it is that has threatened.
that
and you can just kill every piece of legislation, which the Republicans have been doing for umpteen years, and I'm sure the Democrats have done it in the past as well. And, you know, it doesn't really make any sense to begin with to say that everything has to pass by a two-thirds majority or by 60 votes. I mean, that doesn't really make any sense. Somehow that you've got to protect to some degree the minorities, which I guess is the goal that was originally established, but not to the point of blocking legislation that a clear majority wants to accomplish.
I want to distinguish among minorities, though, because I am a firm believer in majority rule and minority rights. But the minority rights I want to protect, for example, are civil rights. If you've got a minority that is, there's a lot of prejudice against that minority, I want to make sure that minority can vote, can have the equal rights that everyone else has. An accused is someone who's particularly likely to be mistreated, someone accused of a crime. The Bill of Rights protects that minority's right to have an attorney and a fair trial. The Bill of Rights protects unpopular speech, for example, a minority speech. That's all protected. And those individual minority rights I absolutely want to protect. Right to practice the religion of your choice, even if it's a minority religion, speech, you know, civil rights laws, etc. That's a huge difference between having that and a minority of legislators able to change policy. If the majority of Americans vote to raise taxes, taxes should go up. If the majority of Americans vote for universal health care, there should be universal health care. If a majority of Americans want machine guns legal, it should be legal. I hate it, but...
But then, Mark, aren't you saying, you know, you're getting rid of representative democracy? I mean, if it shouldn't come down, the whole idea of our republic is it doesn't come down to just what the majority wants.
Okay.
It comes down to what the majority of the representatives want.
Well, I'd be okay with that. I'm okay with the majority of representatives deciding things. What I'm not okay
Good,
with...
I'm glad to hear that.
No, I understand it's a republic. It's not a direct democracy.
Yeah, because direct democracy doesn't work, and it never actually has worked in the history of the world. In fact, studies have shown that for a population of about 100, you can manage a direct democracy. Beyond that, it just becomes chaos.
Well, I know that when I lived in Switzerland for a year, they had... they didn't give women the right to vote in one of the Swiss cantons until 1973. And the reason they didn't is because they had direct democracy. And the way you voted in Appenzeller Innerrhoden was to lift up your sword. And because women didn't have swords, they couldn't vote, Terry. So,
oh, I wish I'd been a sword salesman back then.
You couldn't go in the public square and lift your sword to vote yay or nay if you were a woman. So they said, sorry, women don't get the right to vote. That was changed.
Isn't that a little bit over phallic?
I think it's extremely phallic, actually.
That's really ridiculous. I've just lost all respect for Switzerland. I'm sorry.
It was just one canton, but it actually was the last part of Western Europe to give women the right to vote, this little canton in
Switzerland. Well, we're moving in the same direction, and we should be aware of that, because the new choice is going to be, unless you raise your AR-15, you know, you're not allowed to vote.
That's true. So,
yeah. So
here's what I guess I want to focus on. I understand why a minority entrenched wants to stay in power, but... if Virginia, for example, and I don't mean to pick solely on Virginia. This is happening in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and Minnesota. Anywhere you see...
Let me make you comfortable, Mark,
okay.
as a citizen of Virginia.
Yeah.
I'm still a taxpayer of Virginia,
That's
even
true.
Though I'm not living there at the moment.
Okay.
Virginia's goal is to top Texas in absurd laws, rules, and behavior. So you can go ahead and criticize Virginia. It's okay.
But here's the difference, all right? Texas, at least as of now, before the Latino population grows and we get it moving over to the blue area. Texas is a red state. The majority of the population supports Republicans. That's Texas. It's a reason why I'm not a huge fan of Texas. But Virginia, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, these are all states that vote Democratic, at least in the last two elections. For the other states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, they voted blue for the last five or six elections. And so the majority of the population supports the Democratic Party. But because Republicans control the levers of state government and can draw the district lines and are now talking about changing the electoral vote count, the Republicans can actually stay in control of a state where the majority of the voters want Democrats. And that is a really, really dangerous thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not nice. But, you know, the problem always does come down to is what kind of democracy do we want? And I think even more insidious than some of these procedures that get people in or out of office is once they get into office, the procedures there, and we just mentioned the filibuster as one of them, the procedures there have escalated and transformed to the place, Mark, where the whole attitude of the government really is you don't get anything accomplished. And not only do you not get anything accomplished, if you do get something accomplished, it's immediately undermined. A simple example being, you know, if you pass a bill to do X, Y, Z, and the majority votes for it, then a little time later, somebody, the majority changes, and they vote to unfund it. They don't vote to against the law. They don't even have to repeal the law. They just unfund it. Or they go through like they've done with the ATF. They haven't had a director approved for the ATF for, what, 6 years?
That's true.
So you can castrate every single law that is in passed in our Congress now.
Well,
therefore, the main goal seems to be to, in fact, do nothing.
One of the clearest examples would be the Dodd-Frank law. Now, this is a law actually criticized by many on the left for not going far enough, but that does take a step forward into regulating large financial institutions to stop the too-big-to-fail problem, where basically institutions can gamble a bunch of money. If they win the gamble, they win a ton, and if they lose the gamble, we taxpayers pay them off because they're so big that if they fail, the entire economy falls apart. Well, Dodd-Frank is on its path to fixing that, but the Republicans are preventing Richard Cordray, the director, from being approved. There's just a court case. He probably is going to be thrown out of office because the Republicans refused to allow anyone to be nominated, and they're also working behind the scenes to stop the regulation process. So you're right. They can't kill the bill, which was passed by a clear majority of the Senate and the House and the President and the American people, but they can try to sort of destroy it piece by piece. And that's another way of the minority working its will. One of the things that you mentioned to me, Terry, was that secret amendments actually great way for even a single senator, a single House representative to frustrate the majority. Tell me how that works.
Well, I mean, the classic example was the congressman, what's his name?
Teert. Todd Teert.
Kansas,
yeah.
That castrated the ATF. And basically what he did is he slipped in an amendment, and I guess it's, oh my goodness, almost about 20 years ago now, that he slipped in an amendment that basically prevented the ATF from keeping records of background checks for like more than 24 hours. It defunded the ATF to the point of back in that time, 20-some years ago, they had approximately 2,500 agents. That's all they have today. There's been no increase in ATF agents, even though obviously the complexity of the situation has increased. And the law, the amendment that he slipped in just really took away every enforcement power that the ATF had. And the amendment, I forget the bill that he slipped it into, but it had nothing to do with the bill that was, quote, publicly passed.
And for those of you who don't know, the ATF stands for Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which is a weird concatenation anyway. I guess it comes out of the Prohibition era. But one of the things, for example, that the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Department cannot do is they cannot tell somebody who not to sell a semi-automatic assault weapon with a 100-bullet drum to someone who is extremely inebriated and high at the same time.
Now, or any gun, for that matter.
Well, that's true. So if you're a bartender and you see someone visibly drunk in your bar, you cannot serve them another drink because if you do and they drive home, you can be sued. You can, however, give the person who is too drunk to drive an assault weapon, and that is perfectly legal because of Todd Teert of Kansas.
Yeah, that's his name. Yeah. And it's insane. I mean, it happens. The other thing that happens, Mark, that really discourages me in all this is the more dysfunctional that Congress becomes and the more convinced that American public becomes that government can't work, which is also very destructive, the more this happens, the more the president is forced into, or at least feels he's forced into, taking presidential directives.
That's
which,
true.
Again, is really kind of iffy in terms of the Constitution, but has become a pattern now, and President Obama has issued, I believe, more presidential directives than George Bush did by this point. It's a way of circumventing Congress, even though it may be something that we all agree, or most of us agree, is something that needs to be done. It's putting power into the executive office that the executive office, the president, never should have had. And because of that, the very next president can simply put in another directive that repeals the previous directive. There's no legislative process whatsoever. And it's shifting our government into a chaotic do-nothing Congress, giving the president more power, but even that is tenuous. And this kind of all of these obstacles, all of this chaos that has been introduced and legally introduced, or at least by precedent introduced into our system, is putting us into a situation where people are going to be more and more frustrated And therefore, because they're frustrated and afraid, the public, the majority, will be seeking more extreme solutions. And we know where that heads.
See, I would argue this is really a legislative war. It's a battle, and it's escalation. And Congress does something improper, and then the president does something improper to combat the improperness of Congress, and then Congress responds by doing something more improper, so the president decides to do something even more improper, and lo and behold, representative democracy is in big trouble. I want to talk about that sort of escalating war back and forth when we come back. If you want to dial in, it's 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine and Terry DeKester. This is the Raucous Caucus on We Act Radio, 1480 AM. We'll be right back right after this short message. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with Terry DeKester talking about really the battle between the president and Congress, both breaking the rules here. So here's what happened recently. So President Obama has fewer of his nominees approved than any president, dating back to the end of World War II.
And it also includes a lot, not just of appointees of agencies, but of judges throughout the United States.
So it's both judicial appointments and it's appointments to run his cabinet. Now, this started, to be fair, the Democrats actually filibustered Republican judicial appointments that they considered extreme back in the 1990s. I want to make a distinction with you, Terry, and I don't hear many people making that distinction, but here's what I'd like to make. I'm actually fine with filibustering lifetime appointment of judges. I'm fine with that because, to me, if you're going to appoint a judge for life, a federal judge, particularly a Supreme Court justice, but also on the Federal Court of Appeals, even the lower federal district courts, that judge cannot be fired absent impeachment. They've got to do something really, really bad to lose their job. And because a judge is supposed to be a fair arbiter of justice and to apply the law fairly, I actually am fine with arguing that a judge needs to have 60 votes. So I'm okay with filibustering judges. I'm not okay, however, with filibustering cabinet positions. Cabinet positions are chosen by the President of the United States. They serve at his or her will. We haven't had a her yet, but we will eventually. It seems to me that they go when the president goes. At the end of the day, it's really just the president exercising his or her authority. And to me, the failure to allow Richard Cordray to serve or the people at the National Labor Relations Board, basically they're just trying to shut the government down. So I'd like to see a compromise whereby you can filibuster judicial nominees, but you can't filibuster presidential appointments. What say you?
Well, I mean, basically, I agree with you, Mark, because I think what you're really saying here, and people really have to begin to understand this, is, you know, I think it was Benjamin Franklin said, you've got your democracy now to be able to see if you can keep it. The point not being, you know, that we've got to put up fences and we got to have guns so that we can, you know, prevent the foreign herd from invading us. The point being that democracy, by its nature, is a very, very fragile system of government, because it... What it's trying to do is provide a way that society can be corrected and contained enough so that private dictatorial power cannot ever take over, be that power by the super rich or be that power by a king or whatever. Democracy is an attempt to diffuse power, is really what it's about. And it's complex and it's fragile. And we have to be aware of that, and anything that begins to get in the way, you know, such as these secret amendments, I'm not against, you know, filibusters per se, but the fact that you can simply threaten to filibuster, and the fact that the public never knows who it is that threatened to filibuster, the fact that that can stop an appointment or legislation is absurd.
I tell you,
the fact that everything can be, that you can take any single bill and you can attach to it any pork or any other amendment on any other issue, even on no matter what the bill is about, is absurd. And these kind of things are really what are shattering democracy, and the American public has got to realize that the process of democracy is really what we have to pay attention to.
Well, there's been some reform, and it is in the right direction, and it's clearly not far enough, and I do not want to argue it's far enough, but I am glad to see a tiny, tiny bit of reform. No, we haven't gone back to speaking filibusters, which is what I'd like to see. If you care strongly enough about an issue to obstruct the whole nation's business, damn it, you should be on the floor arguing day and night. Strom Thurmond famously was against the nation's civil rights bills. In 1957, he gave an 18-hour speech. It began in the morning, continued. He was the only one stopping very early, very modest civil rights reform. And finally, after 18 hours of speaking, the senator had to use the facilities. He couldn't hold it in any longer. And his bladder called, and they passed the 1957 Civil Rights Act.
And who the heck wants democracy saved by a bladder call? If that's all you got.
Well, the point is that if only one senator wants to stop this thing, the will of the majority should control. And he can make his impassioned speech for 18 hours, but at some point he has to give up the floor, and obviously America is better for it. So I'd like to see that. That hasn't happened. But one of the things that has happened that I think is a step forward is Rita McConnell, the head of the Democratic-Republican Party in the Senate, have agreed to, number one, stop the two-stage filibuster. It used to be you could filibuster the filibuster. You could actually filibuster a motion to proceed on whether or not you filibuster, and basically that just doubled the time and made the Senate extremely unproductive. That's gone. There's basically one filibuster per bill. That's it. So that's something.
Is it still allowed to be secret? I missed whether or not that's
that was changed. That was the other change. Secret holds are now gone.
Good.
You cannot... You can still secretly amend stuff, just so we're clear here. You can still stick stuff in the bill, and if the majority or minority leader doesn't tell you who sent it, they can just say one of our colleagues put it in and not tell you who. But then you can go and you can say, hey, Reed McConnell, tell us who did this. So there's a little accountability. But what has gone by the wayside, thank God, is secret holds on nominations. It used to be that if you didn't like Richard Cordray or Elizabeth Warren or whomever, you could just put a secret hold and the whole nomination would be closed. And in essence, 99 senators wouldn't get a vote because one was holding a nomination.
I want to just get a little correction here, Mark, that you can help me out with this. You know, the original thing in the Constitution is that the Senate has the power to advise and consent.
That's correct.
Now, that doesn't mean approve.
Well, consent, I mean, most legal scholars would say consent does mean approve. Now, the question would be if the Senate refuses to take a vote on something.
Yeah.
That's a closer question. I mean, clearly, if the Senate does not consent, if the Senate votes down a nominee, there's no question the president can't appoint that nominee. That's clear.
Sure.
That's what consent means. But when the Senate refuses to advise and refuses to determine whether or not they consent, you know, I think an argument can be made that no news is good news. And in fact, the Constitution does provide, as you know, Terry, that during recesses, when Congress is out of session, the president can go ahead and nominate people because the founders understood that if it's really important to the senators, they'll vote somebody down. The recess appointment only lasts until they take a vote, and then they could just go and vote somebody down. So the recess,
which unfortunately is what worked a lot better when they were only in session for maybe a couple weeks or a month out of the year. Now that they're in session the whole darn time almost, it makes it much more difficult.
That's exactly right. And in terms of recess appointments, again, Ronald Reagan had a very large number, George W. Bush less, Bill Clinton less, and then the least of all is Barack Obama, because the Republicans have been keeping the Senate on really never going into recess so that Obama could have the recess appointments. And he tried to do recess appointments during these pro forma sessions, what they're calling, where they gavel in every 3 days and meet for 10 seconds and then gavel out, literally less than a minute. And there was a recent federal court of appeals opinion that said Obama could not appoint people during this time. And so, for example, the National Labor Relations Board.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, the court stripped that entirely.
Right. They said you have to have 5 members of it for it to function, which doesn't make any sense to me. If Congress is not allowing it to function, then...
That's right.
Well, I mean, this is a law. National Labor Relations Act is a law. If Congress doesn't like that law, then change the law. Right. But to say we're not going to allow you to appoint. Same thing with Dodd-Frank. If you don't like Dodd-Frank, repeal it. That's what they argued in the election and they lost. But if you don't like a law and you say, well, we're not going to allow anyone to be nominated. You know, I'm OK with saying, look, I love Elizabeth Warren. But if they vote her down, they say we don't like Elizabeth Warren. Again, they have that right under the Constitution. What I don't know that they have the right to do, but apparently they do, according to the courts, is simply to not allow anyone. They won't allow Mr. Smith. They won't allow anybody. They won't allow someone they love, John McCain, whomever, they won't allow anyone to sit in that seat because they don't want the National Labor Relations Board to function. They don't want the Consumer Protection Board to function. That's really an attack on democracy.
And part of the essence of this is, you know, it's safer for any congressman and any senator, it's safer to do nothing.
That's true.
It's a better chance of getting reelected if you do nothing. Now, you can stand up and say you are for something or against something all you want, but if you don't do anything, then you've got a much better chance of being reelected. And unfortunately, this is the way, to me, that Washington has been ultimately corrupted, because now it is just simply staying in power, the perks of power. They don't even need to use the power, because the perks of power are so grand to begin with. So why would you do anything? Why would you vote, you know, your conscience, when you know darn well if you do, Rush Limbaugh is going to rip it to shreds, you know, and you're going to lose the election the next time around because of the Tea Party or whatever. We've gotten so far away from just honest debate and honest consideration and honest action that I do honestly believe, Mark, our democracy is at peril. I really believe that.
See, here's what happens. I think one party goes too far, and then the other party goes back against them, and then the other party goes back against them, and suddenly we're swinging, you know, for the hills, and we're not doing any kind of compromise or meeting in the middle. So you
right.
have Republicans threatening to default on the national debt. You have people changing district lines while, you know, a black senator is away on Martin Luther King Day in honor of Stonewall Jackson and making sure that blacks can't vote in Virginia. You have the drawing of the gerrymandering lines. You have the filibusters. And then you have Republicans have done more filibusters under President Obama than every single Congress in all of American history for the last 200-plus years have ever done filibusters, by far.
And in fact, they've done it by never having to actually do a filibuster.
That's right.
They just threaten it.
So, and then Republican talking heads, conservatives, they go on these TV programs and they say, the Senate didn't pass a budget, or the Senate's dysfunctional. Why can't the Democrats get anything through while we're filibustering and preventing them from doing
it? Right.
I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've debated, Republicans, that say, you know, the Democrats control the Senate. They don't control the Senate.
No.
I wish they did. If they had 60 votes, which they had for, you know, 6 weeks or so when they passed health care. But they've had 60 votes less than a year of all of Obama's presidency. That was the only time they controlled the Senate.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, we've got to all kind of remember, too, I mean, the whole concept of divided we stand, or united we stand, divided we fall. And it's not so simple as, again, aggression. It's not so simple as civil war. All you've got to do is create in the government enough chaos, enough obstacles to doing anything, and that creates in and of itself divisions to a point that we simply cannot act. And there's one thing that government has to do in a very rapidly changing world is it does have to act. It does have to legislate.
So how do we the people then, this is We Act Radio, AM 1480, how do we act in order to get our government to act? I was talking to my Virginia senator, because as a Democrat, and I want the Democrats, I got to tell you, if this Republican middle of, you know, the national holiday, I like to say middle of the night because that's how I felt about it, little trick occurred where they can basically never allow the Democrats of Virginia to ever have fair votes, I say the Democrats should simply block everything. Bring the state down. Bring it to a standstill. I'm ready for this. You know, don't vote on a budget. Don't withhold their votes on everything, and basically shut the government down until we can have a government that's representative of the people. Now, that may sound very strong. I got to say, after Bush v. Gore, when Al Gore won the election and the Supreme Court appointed George Bush to be president, the loser of the 2000 race in the popular vote and in Florida. Again, I argue that the Senate should filibuster every one of his judicial appointees. But see, that's the problem here. I'm actually arguing for escalation, because sometimes I think it takes a really strong stand to stop a really strong stand. But we never ever get back together. How do we ever persuade politicians to do what's in the American people's interest and not what's in their party's interest? I don't know if you have any clues.
Well, there's only one way, unfortunately, and you can check through history for it. When things fall apart bad enough, then some unity and some progress can be created through, after usually years of trial and destruction.
That's a scary thought.
And if you look throughout history, this is the case. It hardly ever happens. People get complacent. People get distracted. People get corrupted. This is what happens in almost any society, any organization, until there is some point where the whole system is going to fall down. And when the whole system is going to fall down, it's a very dangerous time. It can go either direction, as we saw in Russia, as we saw in Germany. It's a very frightening time. And so my point, and I think what's what we do on WEAC Radio, and I know you do, Mark, is we just keep on trying to educate the public so that the seeds are planted, so that as the crisis heightens, there at least can be the potential for really good change. But until that happens, we're just going to keep on muddling around.
Well, Terry, I'll tell you, you sort of touched on what I think is a less horrific solution. The horrific solution of Russia or Germany or America in the Great Depression is a horror beyond imagination, really.
Yeah.
I like to think that by doing exactly what you say, by educating people, by simply calling them out, you know, they say that you shine a light on a cockroach and it scurries away. That the best way, that sunlight is the best disinfectant. There's probably 12 more cliches
I've
here.
I've never seen a congressman scurry, but anyway.
Shine a light on them. They run away. They're like vampires, I swear. You put up garlic, or they just run away. But seriously, shining a light on it, by us shining a light on what's happening in Virginia, Wisconsin, all these states, shining a light on Bush v. Gore, shining a light on gerrymandering, shining a light on filibustering, and I'd ask President Obama to do the same. Call them out. Because the Virginia Senate plan, we don't know whether it's going to succeed or not. But if you live in the state of Virginia, and WEAC Radio is broadcast throughout a lot of Northern Virginia, if you will call your governor and call your local representative in Virginia and tell him this is disgusting, and you believe that the voters should decide who represents them, rather than letting the politicians decide who's in office, which is actually the beginning of tyranny, and that this is disgusting, that even though the votes were even, they waited till a black guy was gone on Martin Luther King Day to basically disenfranchise blacks in Virginia. If you let people know how disgusting this is, then maybe we can bring our country back from the brink without requiring the German or Russian answer, which is pretty bleak.
That's my hope, too, and that's why we keep on broadcasting, right?
That is exactly right, and I want to thank you, Terry. An hour went very quickly. By the way, Terry, before we close, I don't know if you are able to go to marklevinetalk.com and actually see the video. Have you been able to do that?
Of which video?
MarkLevineTalk.com. You can actually see video starting today and every week from here forward on Sunday from noon to 3. You'll be able to see the Raucous Caucus broadcast noon to 1. See, not just here, see at MarkLevineTalk.com. I'm waving right now to the camera. This is our first inaugural video broadcast, which is why we had a few technical difficulties. And eventually we hope to bring in Terry by Skype and actually show everybody here. And we're also,
if this actually happens, Mark, it's probably going to cause a sexual revolution.
A sexual revolution?
Once we're all broadcast and they see us up close and personal, it's dangerous. Huh. It's exciting. I can't wait.
Terry,
yes?
Have you had your narcissistic gene checked? I just think you might want...
No, I will soon.
You might want to see your doctor about that. All right. That's it for the Raucous Caucus. We'll be back next week at noon. Don't miss us every Sunday, 1480 a.m. And if you missed any part of this, like I said, you can tune into the video. It'll be on my website, marklevinetalk.com, and also presumably on the WEAC Radio website as well. We're going to sign off here, but coming up, I host the Inside Scoop, and we're going to talk about President Obama's inauguration speech and why it really is one of the best, strongest calls for liberal values that I've heard from the president or anyone in a long time. It was really quite an evocative speech, and one that I think hasn't got enough credit in the press. So we're going to go through the speech and also take some of your calls if you want to join in at 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back with the Inside Scoop.
Until we meet again.
Until we meet again. See you next week, Terry, at noon.
Okay, Mark. Thanks.
All right. Take care.